And really pleased to have the chance to introduce and help facilitate a discussion with Scott Page, who is a professor at the University of Michigan, where he runs a Center for the Study of Complex Systems, and who is also on the faculty of the Santa Fe Institute. He's currently on his way, midstream of, on a cross-country drive with his family and dog, to Stanford, where he is going to spend the next year at what part of Stanford? Center for Advanced Study. Right. I thought that was at Princeton. Oh. Anyway, I guess there's two of them. I didn't know that. I'm out of it. I'm an East Coast guy. He also, very relevantly, has just published a book called The Difference: How the Power of Diversity Creates Better Groups, Firms, Schools, and Societies. So the format is going to be, Scott's going to get up here and talk for 20 to 30 minutes about what he's thinking about diversity, what his book is about. Then I'm going to join him on stage and talk to him, ask him questions for 10 or 15 minutes, and then we will have a room-wide conversation. So, Scott, take it away.
Great. The mic's on. I brought miniature copies of the book, if anyone wants one. They're the ultimate cliff notes here, so they're one page thick. It's ironic that I brought my dog here and they've got me on a leash, so I'm going to do my best to hang on. So what I want to do is the following. I want to first talk about where I'm coming from on this issue of diversity. And I want to, what I'm doing and what my work is about is the pragmatic benefits of diversity. So why diversity is actually a bottom line useful thing. Why is diversity something we should care about? In fact, just as much as or possibly more than ability if we're a firm or an organization or a university. So that's orthogonal to where I'm contrasting that to the sort of, you know, standard political, moral, normative reasons why someone might be in favor of diversity. So one of the issues about doing research on diversity is that people are often really uncomfortable about it, right? This is a topic, it's sort of like a third rail. People feel very awkward talking about differences. So one of the things I like to start out by doing typically when I give these talks is by asking the following question. And it's a question I've literally asked now probably 5 or 10,000 people. And that question is this: where do you keep your ketchup? So how many people here keep their ketchup in the fridge? Okay, how many keep it in the cupboard? Okay, we have a couple cupboard people. So it turns out cupboard people tend to either be of sort of British ancestry or they tend to be African Americans from the South. Now, or from Berkeley. People from Berkeley keep their ketchup in the cupboard. Yeah, so just surprised John is a fridge person. So what's interesting about this is if you look at something like ketchup storage behavior, if you look at what somebody else, where they store their ketchup and they store it in a different place than you, you tend to think that, okay, they're a little bit odd, they're a little bit weird, they're different. But the fact is, there's no gene for ketchup storage behavior, right? There's no sense in which we're going to unpack the DNA and find there's the little, you know, guanine that makes it so you store ketchup in the fridge, right? And this other person stores it in the cupboard. So a lot of the differences we see across cultures, across age groups, across ethnic groups, really just come from sort of coordinating behavior. They're the things we're doing. We shouldn't think of them as intrinsic. So what I want to do in this talk is the following. First, I want to lay out a bunch of sort of facts and just sort of loose a couple anecdotes about sort of why diversity is beneficial, sort of give you some sort of grounding as to why there's a basis for what I'm going to talk about. After that, I'm going to talk about why we need the kind of work I'm doing. So the work I'm doing is sort of formal mathematical logical work. What I'm trying to do in some sense is to lay down a science of diversity, right? I'm going to give you the reasons for that. After I do that, I'm going to show how that science works in two cases. I'm going to talk about predictive tasks. So how many people have read The Wisdom of Crowds by Jim Sierwicki? So what I'll do is I'll sort of show the logic behind that, right? So Jim in his book says diversity is important. I'll show you exactly how much diversity is important, okay? And then the last thing I'll do is I'll talk about how diversity is useful in sort of innovation and problem solving issues like that. Okay, so let's start out with some facts. So one fact is this: if you double the size of a city, productivity per worker goes up 13%, okay? So every time a city goes from 100,000 to 200,000, 200,000 to 400,000, 400,000 to 800,000, workers suddenly become 10 to 13% more efficient, okay? And this is a puzzle. Economists have been puzzling of this for a long time, and it appears to be the best possible answer for this is sort of externalities between people, that you've got different, people have different sets of skills. It's not just sort of more specialization. People have different sets of skills and ideas, and this diversity sort of translates into sort of more productivity because you can take an idea from one place and apply it to another place. Let me give a quick example. When the Japanese came over and visited American auto industries, they took back this idea of just-in-time inventory, right, which pretty much transformed the auto industry and cost my home state, Michigan, a lot of business. They didn't learn this from the auto companies. They learned this from the Detroit supermarkets because they were shocked to find fish in Detroit, right? Fresh fish in Detroit. Fish has always been just in time. So has bananas, right? What they learned from the supermarkets is that they could cut down on inventory costs by having things be just in time. Let me give another example. The first 10 Nobel Prizes in chemistry went to 10 people, people like Madame Curie. They were great scientists. So Walter's book, right, on Einstein, we tend to think of these amazing scientists. The last 10 Nobel Prizes in chemistry have gone to how many people? 27, right? That's 2.7 per Nobel Prize. How many people can get a Nobel Prize? Somebody has a hand right there. Only three. So 27 and one, another 20 have taken out ads in newspapers saying, I was robbed, I was part of the team, right? In some sense, there's no more, we've sort of lost, we haven't so much that we've lost great scientists. It's now that there's just more great scientists, and they no longer work alone on little islands with laboratories. They work in teams, and John could probably talk about this better than I can, right? So these collaborations between teams of people basically are much more productive than individuals, okay? The last thing I want to talk about, that's sort of an anecdote. Brian Uzzi at Northwestern has basically looked at all scientific publications over a 20-year period and asked which ones get cited more, which are the most important papers. And what you find is the more authors that a paper has, the more often it's cited, and the more diverse the disciplines are that the authors are in, the more the paper's cited. So what this says is more people, more diverse people, better outcomes in the academic realm. Okay? Those are all examples of problem solving, where we see diversity useful in problem solving. Let me give some examples of prediction. So we all remember in Sierwicki's book, The Wisdom of Crowds, he talks about this example of Galton's steer. So Francis Galton went to something called the West of England Fat Stock and Poultry Exhibition. So now anybody in media could think, okay, this is pre-marketing, right? They didn't quite know how to name things then. But at this Fat Stock and Poultry Exhibition, 787 people guessed the weight of this steer. The average guess was 1,197 pounds. The steer actually weighed 1,198 pounds. Okay? Now, Jim and I do a bunch of these sort of things together, things like this Aspen thing together. And Jim's amazed by this. That's because he lives in New York. He went to Yale. He's never seen a steer. So it's shocking to him. I actually owned 9 cattle when I lived in Iowa. And guessing the weight of a steer within 50 pounds or so isn't that hard. They're just like big people. Okay? And having had big relatives probably helped me in that case. But there's other, you know, sort of more systematized examples, like the Vegas sports betting lines. If you look across like a 20-year period and you ask, in those games where Vegas has said one team is going to win by 6 points, how much do they win by? And the answer is pretty much exactly 6 points. So this idea that crowds of people can make accurate predictions is starting to transform the business community. So what companies are doing, HP does. Google has something called Profit. They have internal prediction markets. So what they do is they have people within the firm predict how many printers they're going to sell or how many people are going to, you know, use Google Gmail, that sort of thing. So what they do is they create this giant prediction market inside their company. Everybody makes a prediction, and they use this to sort of guide business decisions. What they found from using these prediction markets and comparing them, so Hewlett-Packard basically compares these to some highly paid economists, so someone like me, right, some, you know, guy who is trained as an economist who sits down and figures out exactly how many copies this printer will sell. What they find is if the economist is right, which in praise of economics is most of the time, the economist is a little bit better than the crowd. But occasionally, the economist is completely wrong, right? And the crowd is rarely completely wrong. When is the economist wrong? Well, when things that aren't in the economist model come into play, like aesthetics, right? So the economist doesn't have a little dummy variable for ugly printer, right? But if the printer is ugly, everybody who works for HP can look at it and say, that's an ugly printer, nobody's gonna buy it, right? So what we get is the crowd can often be better than an expert. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to talk about why, so if we know diversity is useful, I want to talk about why do we need to move beyond metaphor? Why do we need a sort of logic that I'm trying to lay out? Why do we need sort of a formal theory of why diversity is beneficial? And here's why. There's a lot of sort of competing ideas. You'll hear people say, two heads are better than one. That's why we need diversity, right? At the same time, you'll hear people say, too many cooks spoil the broth, okay? So if we're trying to decide, do we put together a diverse team, or do we have some sort of lone individual solve this, or do we take a bunch of people who are homogeneous and try and solve it, we have to think about, do we use this metaphor, or do we use this metaphor? Which saying do we invoke? Well, that's not a good way to sort of have progress. That's not a good way to make business decisions. So what we want to do is we want, in some sense, have a deep understanding of why is it that two heads are better than one. And the reason why two heads are better than one is often two different heads think about the world differently, and I'll show how that works through some examples. And why do too many cooks spoil the broth? Well, let's think about it. If you're making soup, if my wife and I are making soup, and she puts in a bunch of cayenne pepper, and it's just too hot, I can't take it out, There's no anti-cayenne pepper. I can search through the spice store. Nothing can be done. So cooking is irreversible, right? So if you have an irreversible process, like a military campaign or a ratatouille, right, you can't back it up, right, and start off. So nobody ever said too many carpenters spoiled the house, right? Because having built the house, right, the carpenters, just, when they make a mistake, they just pound the board back out. So there is the equivalent of anti-cayenne pepper. So what we want is we want to move from a world where we say something like, well, the faster I throw it and the bigger it is, the more damage it does, to a world in which we've got equations like force equals mass times acceleration, right, so we know exactly how things work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you just one today, an equation that looks sort of like force equals mass times acceleration for diversity. And once we've got that sort of equation, then if we're running a firm, if we're running a nonprofit, if we're running a university, we can think about how much diversity do we have and how useful is it. Okay, so let me go back. I'm going to talk about the prediction idea, and let me go back to the case of ketchup. Okay, so when we think about, let's suppose we're all going to predict who's going to win the Democratic nomination for president, or who's going to win the Republican nomination for president in 2008. The way this would work is each one of us would have, if we sort of like to say open up the pumpkin, if we open up each one of our heads, each one of us is going to have our own little model, right? We're going to have our own little way of sort of interpreting the world and making predictions from that interpretation. So the way psychologists think of this is they think of us as placing things in categories, okay? And then once we've got things in categories, we make predictions based on those categories. So let me give sort of a fun example of those categories. So the ketchup idea, the ketchup example sort of gives us the right direction. If I keep my ketchup in the fridge, I'm going to think of ketchup like other things in the fridge. So I'm going to think of it like mayonnaise and mustard and stuff like that. If I keep my ketchup in the cupboard, I'm going to think of my ketchup more like an oil, right? So I'm going to have the ketchup in different boxes. Well, here's an experiment a friend of mine did, who's an anthropologist. Anthropologists have something called pile sorts. And what they do is the following. They'll give you a long list of things like this. Usually it's much longer than this. And they'll ask you to put it in piles. And in each pile, you're supposed to put stuff that are similar, right? So each pile is supposed to have things that are the same. Different people will have different piles, right? In this instance, since we each have different piles, that means we sort of think about the world in different ways. Now, this example is sort of contrived, but one of the things I want to, so if you think of these things and you have to put them in piles, here's sort of an interesting stylized fact. Notice that there's spam. I want you to focus on three things: spam, canned salmon, and Atlantic salmon. If your income is under $30,000, it's almost certainly the case that you have Atlantic salmon in the same category as canned salmon. If your income is above $100,000, it's almost certainly the case that you have spam in the same category as canned salmon, and you have Atlantic salmon somewhere completely else, right? Basically, you have a category called canned stuff that I don't eat, right? and you don't put it in there. Whereas someone else who maybe doesn't have the income to afford fresh salmon would just put all the fish products in the same category. So depending on, and here's where things like standard notions of diversity come into play. So if we think about things like culture, race, ethnicity, gender, age, experience, those sort of things, those affect what our set of life experiences are, those affect how we place things in categories, those then in turn affect how it is that we make predictions, right? So if you look at the data on does diversity matter? Does ethnic diversity matter? Or racial diversity matter for boards of directors? One of the things you find is that this is a case where it has a big effect. Why? Because boards of directors do a lot of predicting, right? They predict how the world's going to unfold. And if you have a whole bunch of cookie cutter people who all look the same, who are all the same age group, who are all trained at the same places, they're likely to place things in the same categories, and they're likely to make sort of the same causal inferences. Okay, so how do we do a math behind this? Well, the way we do a math behind this is we can sort of do some simple statistics. I'm going to write, this is in the book, but I'll put this up here. There's something I call the diversity prediction theorem. Sorry about the font. Okay. And the diversity prediction theorem says this. Collective error. So let's suppose we're predicting something like the weight of a steer, or we're predicting who's going to win an NFL game. By collective error, what I mean here is squared error. So if I'm off by 20, if I'm off 20 too high, I'd square it and get 400. And if it's off by minus 20, I'd also square it. So the minus becomes a positive, I get plus positive 400. So this is just squared error that we do in statistics. It turns out that the collective error, the squared error, so what do I mean by collective error? So if I take everybody's prediction and I add them up and I get an average prediction, and I ask, how good does the crowd do? So this is in some sense what the crowd does, right? It turns out the crowd's error is equal to the average error, which is in some sense, on average, how able are people at predicting? How good are they at predicting, right? So this is their average ability, minus the diversity in the predictions. Okay? So let's think about this for a second. So America is this strange place where we just worship ability, right? We put bumper stickers on our cars saying, my child is an honors student, blah, blah, blah. We talk about SAT scores, we talk about this, you know, we talk about IQs and stuff like that. And diversity is considered this sort of politically correct thing that you have to talk about so you don't get sued, right? But if we do the math, if we actually sit down and sort of do the math in a correct way, what we find is that ability and diversity enter this equally, right? It's not 10,000 times ability minus 0.001 times diversity. So let's go back to the Galton Steer example to see how this works. The crowd in Galton's example was off by actually less than a pound. So they were off by 0.6, okay? The average error was 2,956, which you can think of this as about 54 squared, okay? So this means everybody was off by about 50 pounds. Some were 50 pounds too high, some were 50 pounds too low. But basically, most of us, with a little bit of training, I could take you out to some like auctions, we could have some pie, we could watch a few cattle, I could get you all within about 50 pounds, okay? So we'd all be within about 50 pounds. We square that, right? It's about 2,900. What was the variance or the diversity in the predictions? Well, in this case, the diversity in the predictions was 2,955.4, right? So the crowd's almost perfectly right? And the reason almost perfectly right is because their ability was pretty good, not amazing, but reasonably good, but their diversity was high enough that they canceled out any error made by the ability. So this is always true. So here's a funny thing about, so having written this book, the book has this equation in it. A whole bunch of people who like, you know, work in the quote unquote real world have basically written me and said, we had some data on predictions and I plugged it in and it worked, right? Well, the thing is, this is like the Pythagorean theorem, right? Where a squared plus b squared equals c squared. It always works, right? It's a mathematical theorem. It's always gonna be true, right? So this is always gonna be the case.
Is this your own concoction?
So here's what's interesting. So this is this my own concoction? Turns out three different people got tenure for this, okay? Which speaks volumes about how the academy, no. It's already tenured. One of them was a statistician, right? One of them was a computer scientist, one of them was an economist. This was all done in the 1970s. But it was not done with diversity here. It was done with variance here. And all of this work was done in terms of signal processing models, where you've got signals that get random errors. So my contribution to this is to think to show, if we go back to the sort of arugula thing, to actually construct a model of people having models and show how if people have diverse models, right, then they make diverse predictions. And the diversity of those predictions are as important as the average error of those predictions.
How did you get the diversity number again?
So the way you get it's really just the variance. I'm just asking how much do people's predictions differ from one another?
But it wouldn't have mattered if all the people in the crowd were from Iowa.
No, it wouldn't. So this is what gets interesting, right? So they could have all been from, in this case, they were all from the west of England probably, right? So when we think about where does diversity, what we really care about in terms of performance is what I, again, this sort of inside the pumpkin diversity, right? How do we, what leads us to make different predictions? Do we make different predictions, right? I mean, that's what's coming into play here. But the question you're raising.
You come up with a number because it was a numerical exercise.
It's numerical, right. That's right.
It would be much harder to come up with such a number in many other kinds of circumstances.
No, that's exactly right. There'd be other circumstances that would be very difficult to think about. Like if you're trying to decide who to hire, for instance, right? And some people think this person, somebody thinks something else. It's still gonna be the case that in the background, this is gonna be holding true. How well you do as a crowd is gonna depend on how well you do individually minus, on average, minus how different you are, okay? Yeah?
Well, I mean, there's an issue. If you think you have like one person testing.
Right.
Okay, and you add a second person, are they helping or hurting?
Right.
Okay, well, it would depend on if you think that there's underlying bias. You know, if you've got an unbiased estimator, that's one thing. But
that's right.
So
all the previous work was just talking about sort of biased versus unbiased estimates.
And make it worse.
Absolutely, and that's exactly.
Even adding diverse people.
That's right, and adding more able people can, here's the funny thing, you can add people who are sort of worse, but different and make you better off, right? And you can add people who, right? So what you wanna think about when you're adding a person, you wanna say, what are they doing to average error? What are they doing to diversity, right? And so but what's interesting about this is that we tend to think, well, we should hire someone who's smarter, we should hire someone who's better, right? But if the person you're hiring isn't any different from anybody else you've got, and they're not actually changing your average error at all, right? You're not going to do any better collectively. But if you hire someone who's actually a little bit worse, you know, again, worse is, this is one of the problems. We tend to think individualistically. So we tend to think this person is worse on their own. But we have to think contextually. We have to think, how does this, what does this person add to the mix, right? So this person on their own could be a little bit worse, but could be so different from other people and biased perhaps in a different, you know, I hate to use the word bias because the thing is bias suggests, I like to think of people having models. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
The true thing tends not to be in the center of the crowd's beliefs.
Right.
If the errors tend to go in one direction.
Right.
Okay, adding more diversity makes more of that kind of error, you're going to make matters worse. Right?
Yeah,
well, experts think free trade is a good idea.
Right.
Non-experts tend to think it's not a good idea. As you get more and more diverse non-experts, they think it's more and more not a good idea. Okay. And you end up with the idea that you're pulling, you're getting worse. You're
that's exactly right. And so the thing is, if you have, and so, but there's a case where average error is high among the, so let's take non-experts on free trade, right? Average error is high. So, you know, Brian Kaplan argued, average error is high, diversity is low. So where does democracy fail? And where do markets fail? When average error is high and diversity is low. Right? So where do systems fit? So when would this number be big, right? So big collective error is a bad thing. So how could this number possibly be big? It can only be big if this is big and this is small, right? So what that means is you need everybody making mistakes, everybody in some sense having a, and this to be small. And so for this is small, that means a common bias, right? So this is basically, you know, putting math on your insight, right?
The diversity could be very big, but it's all in the same direction.
But then it's, yeah. But if it's all in the same direction, then it's not that much, that diverse.
But the reason,
right?
In that example is that there's a conventional wisdom about trade among non-experts, which is,
and conventional wisdom is going to be mean less diversity. So let me give an example. So if you do this equation, and I've had, and you can take data, I had a bunch of human resources people guess the weight of a 747, right? They were all off, like, they were off by a factor of 1,000. They had, like, billions of tons as opposed to, you know, so there was this huge average error, right? And still quite a bit of diversity, but the average error was just swamping what diversity existed, right? But again, what we want to think about, where this is going to play out in businesses, where this is going to play out in the context of a university or an organization, is you're going to have people who are reasonably good, and you're trying to think about who's our next hire, right? Who do we bring into the mix? Who do we add to our board? And there's a tendency to think, oh, let's add this person because they're really good, right? But in comparing two people, you want to ask, right, if you're involved in predictive tasks, you want to think about sort of not only how are they individually, but how are they compared to the other people we've got? Because diversity matters every bit as much as ability. Let me move on and we can add some more questions. So that's prediction. The other thing is, the next thing I want to talk about really quickly is problem solving. Because here's a place where diversity really has, in some sense, a larger role in terms of innovation. So let me give a quick example I'd like to give that comes from the book. When Ben & Jerry's came up with New York Super Fudge Chunk ice cream, and this is why you want to own an ice cream company, they got a big table, and on that table they put pints of ice cream. And they arranged it so on this axis there were more chunks, there were more sort of chips. And on this axis the chips got larger. So in this little corner of the table, it was just like one little chip. It was like, find the chocolate chips. And in the far corner, it was just like a box of chocolates with a little bit of cream surrounding it, right? So this was what I'm going to formally call their perspective. This is how they encoded the problem of find a good type of ice cream, okay? Encoding it that way, then what they did is they randomly selected a pint on the table, and then they looked to the north, south, east, and west. So for computer scientists, this is the von Neumann neighborhoods. They didn't call it that. They just looked sort of a pint with more chunks, fewer chunks, bigger chunks, smaller chunks. And they have professional tasters. This is even a better job than owning an ice cream company, is being a professional taster. And they sort of tasted their way to what would be like a local optimum. Okay? Now, one of the things that, one of the places I hang out is the Santa Fe Institute, and we talk a lot about sort of adaptation on rugged landscapes. So this is an ice cream landscape. What you can think of is you can think of each pint as having an elevation, which is how good it is. So if this pint's really good, it's really high, and if this pint's really bad, it's really low. So what they were doing is they're sort of searching over this rugged landscape. So when they try a pint that's better, they climb up. When they try a pint that's worse, they move down. Where they're going to get stuck is going to be a peak on that landscape. So humans, when they're solving problems, or evolution when it's solving a problem, tends to get stuck on these peaks, right? Now, where does diversity come in? Diversity comes in the sense that when I'm trying to solve a problem, or if John's trying to solve a problem, we encode it differently, okay? So let's suppose Ben and Jerry, I'll draw this up. So Ben and Jerry have their things in this giant rectangle, and they get stuck right here at this point X, okay? Now suppose there's another point over here, Y, that's a little bit better. They're not gonna find that because they're looking to the north, south, east, and west, and this is a peak. But suppose they hire a consultant who says what really matters here is calories. So they're going to line up these same pints by caloric rank. So this is someone who maybe grew up with Jenny Craig or Weight Watchers or something, right? So I think all that matters is calories. So it could be if you line them up by calories, X and Y are right next to one another, right? So they're stuck at X. The consultant says, why don't you try Y? They leap all the way over here to Y, and they think, wow, Y tastes a lot better. And then they think this consultant is a genius, right? The point is, the consultant isn't a genius. The consultant is just different. Now, what's interesting about this is the consultant doesn't even have to be better than Ben and Jerry. So you could ask, on average, how good would this do compared to this? And the answer is Ben and Jerry could be better at solving this problem than the consultant. But by virtue of being different, the consultant's useful. Now, you might say, does this mean any way of looking at a problem is useful? No. One of the real sort of paradoxes of diversity is, while there's lots of diverse ways to be useful, there's infinitely more diverse ways to be completely non-useful, right? So suppose I arrange these same pints by chew time, right? Or masticity, right? So I said, let's line them up from the one that, you know, slides down to the one that's sort of like really hard to chew. That would be a terrible way to represent pints of ice cream. And if we plotted that, it would probably look like this, right? You know, a good one would be next to a bad one, next to a good one, next to a bad one, next to a good one, right? What we'd like is we'd like to create what we call Mount Fuji problems, where we've represented the problem in such a way that it's really, really easy to solve, right? That we've aligned the pints so we can just sort of climb right up to the top. Now, one interesting thing on the sort of chew time, I was giving this talk one time and I mentioned the chew time thing, and somebody came up afterwards and said that they used to work as a consultant for the cereal industry, and chew time is a very important metric. It turns out that if you arrange pints by chew time, they have what they call mush at this end and something they call bark and twigs at this end, that like all cereal lies in this little interval with one exception. Does anyone know the exception? Grape nuts. So grape nuts lies way out here. All bran, you just have to wait. All bran has got a very short half-life where it's in this range. It sort of starts out in barks and twigs, and it's mush if you don't eat fast, right? So, but there is a time period where all bran's in that region. Okay, so the second thing is once they've got this encoding, remember I said that they went to the north, south, east, and west. A second way that people can differ when you're solving problems is not just in how we encode problems, but how we think about solving them. So there's a huge literature on what are known formally as heuristics, which are just sort of problem-solving techniques. Let me just give sort of one example. There's a famous example called Do the Opposite, okay? And this comes from this book by Nailbuff and Ayers called Why Not, right? But it's also famous from a Seinfeld episode. George realizes that everything he's ever done in his life has been completely wrong. So he decides to do the opposite, right? So whatever he's thinking he should do, he does the exact opposites. And by the end of the show, he's got a girlfriend, he works for the Yankees, everything's great, right? His life's turned around. How does this work in business? Well, the way Do the Opposite works here is you have something like, so think of Walmart as being this company that says, we just want the lowest price possible. That's sort of what I was taught when I learned basic economics, right? You sort of compete on price. Starbucks did the opposite, right? They said, let's see how much we can sell coffee for, right? And they've succeeded tremendously, right? Nirvana, which was like the great grunge heavy metal band of all time, decides, hey, let's do an Kurt Cobain gets on, does Unplugged, right? November 1993, sits down the MTV studios, right? And plays acoustic guitar. It's the best-selling heavy metal album ever, right? Marcia Inhorn, who's an anthropologist who does fabulous work, decided to get a lens on how different cultures work, decided to look at infertility in overpopulated countries, right? You've got an overpopulated country. What's the least obvious thing to look at? Who's not able to have kids, right? And she figured that would give this incredible lens on how cultures treat people who are different, right? So oftentimes doing the opposite of what everybody else is doing is going to really pay off. So if we take this idea that people have diverse perspectives and heuristics, and we think of each one of us not as having just one perspective and one heuristic, but being this collection, this toolbox of perspectives and heuristics, right? So each one of us is just this amazing collection. So one of the things I really try and push in my work is we have this sort of measuring stick or thermometer notion of intelligence, right? So somebody's got an IQ of 130 or 120 or 110, or someone's got an LSAT score, an SAT score, but instead to sort of embrace people in their fullness and think of us as this collection of tools, right? So here's the following experiment you can do. This is what leads off the book. Suppose on a computer I create a whole bunch of sort of artificial people that have these perspectives and heuristics. And then I rank them from smartest to dumbest in terms of how well they do on a problem. Okay? So I've created this sort of artificial world on a computer, and I've given everybody their own little SAT score. Okay? Then I take the 20 smartest people, what I used to call the Halberstam group, right? So the best and the brightest, and I have them work together to try and solve some problem, right? They have their own little team. I compare them to a team of sort of random but smart people. Okay? What it turns out, what kept happening was the random but smart people kept beating the Halberstam team, the best and the brightest. So I thought this was coding error, so I recoded it. I did it in all sorts of different formats, and I called this a green eggs and ham theorem for a while, because it was true on a tree, it was true on a graph, it was true on a train. It seemed, no matter how I set it up, it seemed to be true. But I couldn't figure out why it was true. And eventually I brought in a co-author, because I wasn't sort of smart enough on my own, which sort of proves the point maybe more than anything else, who's very different than me. She's a Chinese woman. Lu Hong and I hammered out a set of conditions under which diversity really sort of trumps ability. When is it the case that a diverse group of people is actually better than a group of the best? And what it turns out is that the problem has to be really hard is basically the key assumption. If the problem is easy, hire somebody who can solve it. Once the problem becomes incredibly hard, you're better off having diverse people than the quote-unquote best performing individuals. And the reason why is the best performing individuals, if you sample from a large enough population, tend to have fairly similar perspectives and heuristics. Why? Because they've got the perspectives and heuristics that are good for that problem, right? So if I've got a particular problem and I take the 20 people who are very best at solving that problem, they tend to have more similar perspectives and heuristics than if I just take sort of 20 smart people. Now you could say, well, that just can't be true. Let me give a sort of a real world example where that is true. There's a company called Innocentive, started by Alf Bingham, that is a spinoff of Eli Lilly. And what this is a company where if you have a problem you can't solve, you can just post it. And these are mostly problems from sort of biotech, right, and healthcare industries. A third of the problems posted to Innocentive have been solved. Now, who's putting, you think, okay, 33% isn't that good except for in baseball, right? But 33% is amazing because these are places like Procter & Gamble, which spends like $100 million on research every year. They can't solve a chemical problem. They post it to the web with a reward of $10,000. I think for $10,000, we want somebody to solve this. And some dentist in Bangladesh solves the problem, right? Now, there's no way the dentist in Bangladesh is, in some sense, better at biochemistry than Procter & Gamble's labs, right? But the thing is, what they were doing is they're sampling from this wide variety of people, right? Literally 100,000 searchers list on the Innocentive site. So they're able to leverage this incredible diversity in a sort of connected world, right, to solve the problem. Okay, so let me quickly summarize then, and then we'll have open questions. So the first big point is this, is that the pumpkin is limited. No matter how smart each one of us is, individually, we're really pretty limited, right? So even though you think about sort of bringing in, you know, individually talented people, what you really want to think about is, how do we take advantage of the incredible collection of skills and knowledge in terms of tools, in terms of perspectives, heuristics, right, interpretations, that sort of stuff. The second thing is, I think we really want to think in terms of toolboxes, not in terms of thermometers. I think it's incredibly important that we think of people as collections of tools, not as test scores. It's demeaning, I think, to try and capture some of the single number. The third thing is, I want to talk about something for a second, what I call the parable of the bicycles. And that's this. There's been hundreds of studies on how do diverse groups do compared to homogeneous groups. And the answer is the mean is about the same. On average, diverse groups do just about the same as homogeneous groups, averaging across hundreds of studies. What's the difference then? So you could say, you're not saying anything then, right? The empirical reality seems to go against your theory. However, if you look at the distribution of performance, the diverse groups have much higher variance. So the very best groups are diverse, and the very worst groups are diverse. So if you have a homogeneous group, you're going to get 80%. Right? You're going to get between 75 and 85. If you have a diverse group, you're going to get between 50 and 100, right? And it's just going to be more spread out. So here's the parable of the bicycle. So you could say, well, geez, why have diversity? Then that just gives me higher variance with the same mean, which is something we try and guard against. But here's the parable of the bicycle. Suppose I take a whole bunch of 5 or 6-year-old kids and ask, how far can you ride a bike in 50 meters? Okay, and I plot that distribution. So how far can you ride a bike in 10 seconds? I'm sorry. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to mean of about maybe 50 meters with a pretty wide variance. Why? Because some kids can ride bikes. They're going to go a long way. Other kids are going to wipe out, right, and have blood on their knees, and they're going to get nowhere. Now suppose I take those same kids and ask them, how far can you run in 10 seconds? I'm going to get about the same mean. I'm going to get about 50 meters, but I'm going to get a really tight distribution. Okay? Well, this is exactly like the diversity data. The homogeneous groups are like the kids running. Very tight distribution with a mean of about 50. The diverse groups, like the kids riding the bikes, a really spread out distribution with about the same mean. Now, if I said to you, where should you invest as a mode of transportation? In bikes or in running? The answer would be bikes. And you think all we have to do is learn how to ride the bikes, right? If we can just teach people to learn to ride these kids to learn to ride the bikes, they'll all go 80 meters, right? The same is true with sort of managing and leveraging diverse groups. The question is, how do you figure out how to leverage it so you can go, you know, so you can get the high end of the distribution? How do you prevent things from falling apart? So if you look at sort of most leading business schools, and most, this gets back to the sort of $6 billion spent by firms on diversity training and education, everybody, I think, recognizes that the potential's there, that diversity is this offers this incredible potential for society to sort of move forward, right? But the challenge is, in some sense, the management problem, how do you leverage it, right? How do you get it so you can move to the high end? The last point, and I'll end with this. If you go back to the sort of diversity prediction theorem, we know that the crowd's error, right, is equal to the average error minus the diversity, right? And so we know that if people have different models, they make good predictions. But here's a second stylized fact about people having different models. If each one of us has a different model of how the world works, and we sit down and we have a meeting to try and figure out what's going to happen, we're going to disagree, right? And because we're going to disagree, it's not going to be very much fun. So if you go to some sort of meeting, you're on some board, and everybody's disagreeing, our natural reactions tends to be that was incredibly frustrating and therefore bad. And if everybody agreed, we thought, oh, that was so great. Everybody agreed, it was just wonderful. Now, if everybody agreed, if I go back to the mathematics, right? The collective error equals average error minus the diversity. If diversity is zero, if we all agreed, then it better have been the case that we were all right, right? That every one of us was correct. And if every one of us is correct, why were we wasting our time having a meeting, right? So if you're at a meeting and everybody agreed and it was all wonderful, then it better have been a really simple problem. But if you walk out of a meeting and it was really frustrating because people disagreed, but you knew it was a hard problem, then you should say to yourself, that's a good thing. I'm really glad I'm frustrated, right? I'm glad that my worldview was challenged, because the thing is, we probably got a better decision, right? So this is the one stylized fact that always holds. If you ask people, how was your diverse interaction? How was your meeting with people? I mean, you bring people from marketing and engineering, if you bring young people and old people, between whites and blacks together, they all say, that was really frustrating. That may be true. But what's also probably true, if you listen to one another, is it was probably also better, right? And that's one of the things we have to learn to leverage. All right, so I'll turn it over to David. Thanks.
That's fascinating. I'm just going to sit up here and mostly call on you, but I wanted to just ask a couple things first. Because to me, the most interesting piece of this for us to pursue further is the practical consequences, which you've touched on a number of times. Right. But I was thinking about the fact that every major company has one woman on its board, right? Now, is that a good thing? I mean, it's better than not having any. Is that what you're telling us? But it would be better if they had one woman and a couple of people from from different countries? Or how do you play this out in that sort of context as a leader?
So there's several ways to think about it. So one is that if you put one woman on a board, or sometimes I'm the one economist on a diversity meeting, right? Then what happens is there's a lot of evidence that people feel the need to play that identity group or that functional group. So if you're the only woman on board, you somehow feel compelled to think like a woman, because you're feeling like, I have to represent women here. Someone in a position where they're not being asked to think like themselves, right, but to represent other people, they're not going to be as effective as a general. So there's a lot of evidence for the need for critical mass, right, that you need people to actually feel comfortable in their own skin to say how they really feel, as opposed to sort of trying to represent something that they may be, you know, a member of, but they're really not. The second thing, though, and I think you can push things further, and Heather Gerken at Harvard Law School pushes this, Heather went to Yale now, is that, and I talk about this some in the book as well, is that this presumption of sort of, quotas in a weird sort of way, we should have 10% this, 20% this, 30% this, really, maybe misses the point. There may be places where we want majority-minority groups making decisions. In the legal realm, there's a lot of reasons why you can make this case even more strongly, but even in the case of, like, the university, when we're trying to make a decision, it's not the case that we just want, 10% minority representation. A lot of times, if diversity is useful, we may want 50% or 60%. It also may be the case that we want lots of, you know, oftentimes we'll put one junior faculty member on a committee, right? Well, they're, you know, half of our faculty. Why don't we have 40%? You know, so it, I think it's, the question shouldn't necessarily be, you know, should you have two instead of one? The question might also should be, you know, should you have 40% versus, you know, 20%?
But how do you find that out? How do you figure that out, whether you should have 40%?
I think you want to think about what the, if the reason you're having those people on is in some sense a political reason, that you need to have representations in different groups. So let me give an example. When the University of Michigan's hiring a president or a provost, we have someone from the each union on that selection committee. Those people are there for purely political reasons to make sure, and they're really representing the union in that case. They want to make sure that this person isn't going to try and break the unions, right? And they're going to, they basically have a veto play there. So there's a case, I think, where you want the sort of one or two. But I think I really, in some ways, feel uncomfortable with this idea of sort of, you know, classifying people by identity group or and saying you want a certain percentage of those things. Instead, I think what you want to do is you want to sort of look for people who think differently, who have different, you know, past experiences, who bring different things, and try and keep, you know, I think one of the things that companies don't do enough of is keep track of who voted for what and who thought what in the past. And what you want to do is you want to keep track of sort of, you want to bring together people who are going to think differently, right? And so that often is going to manifest itself in lots of diversity in the traditional ways, but other times it may lead to very little. I mean, and this is sort of an uncomfortable thing to think about, but you could have a group of people that all looks the same, that isn't very diverse, and you could have a group of people that looks incredibly diverse, but all went to Yale and graduated in 1973, you know.
Well, that's what happens where I work, for example, where we've had these, you know, very rigid diversity requirements for years, and they hire a lot of black people, all of whom went to Yale and Harvard. You know, and that's true in journalism, at high-end journalism, and in fact, we don't have much diversity despite years of regulation. But still, I got to believe it's better than if we didn't do it. I mean, because you and I were talking before about how, you know, there's a certain analogy here to the green thing, where companies, by law and by unions and by other means, were forced to diversify against their will, but it turned out probably, by your analysis, to be good for their business, just as companies are sort of going green and now they're saying, wait, this is good business. We don't even need to just do it because, you know, we want to be environmentalists.
I think, no, that's absolutely true. As long as they're doing it, I think that, first of all, I think it is absolutely true, but the thing is, I think you can, both in green policies and in diversity policies, you can do it in a way where you're not really engaging. I think to the extent these companies engage, right, and organizations engage, they do find that it's beneficial.
But right? You know, one of the things that your whole analysis raises for me is, how do you define diversity and how can you identify diversity? And what, you know, in almost every situation, the challenge of identifying genuine diversity must be very challenging, right?
So I think this is where it becomes very context dependent. So let's suppose that, let me give some examples that I'm very familiar with. So let's suppose that I sit on graduate admissions committee and we're trying to decide who do we let into a graduate program, right? And, you know, students apply for these things and you look at grade point averages and you have SAT scores and you have the college they went to. And there's this real tendency to sort of want to like just take some weighted average of grade point average plus, you know, test score and to have that be a proxy for ability. Right, and then to think, let's take high ability people, and then to say, oh boy, we don't have any women, we don't have any minorities. Let's take the two highest ranked women who want to study international relations, right? And let's take, we don't have any minorities who want to study Congress, so let's take, you know, one minority student representing Congress. So you sort of have this ability thing first, that you think of that as the cake, and then diversity is sort of like these multicolored sprinkles you throw on so you feel good about yourself. Instead, what you should do is you should sit there and say, what is the purpose of our department? What are we trying to do? And what we're trying to do is we're trying to, you know, train the next generation of scholars who help us understand American politics. So let's suppose we have someone who grew up in New Orleans and was in New Orleans during the whole Katrina mess, went to Tulane, transferred someplace else, right, transferred to Oklahoma. He's got solid grades, solid test scores, sort of comes out, you know, pretty high, but maybe wouldn't have made it in. That person's bringing so much more to the table, right, in terms of understandings of how American politics plays out in the streets and in cities, than, you know, one more, you know, person who's lived a fairly insulated life, right? And so we're going to let that person in because our experience has been that those people end up having a larger impact. So we have a student who's very successful, who was, you know, happened to be a minority student but had been a police officer for 7 years, right, in a largely, you know, urban district. That we knew that this person studying crime, right, and race relations would have a huge leg up, independent of that person's race, over, you know, some, you know, I hate to use the word cookie cutter undergrad with good grades. But, and so what we do is we ask, what is our purpose? And we think in terms of tools. We ask, what tools do our list of applicants bring? And we look for diverse sets of tools. And those are gonna, those are almost always gonna correlate with the other classifications, with identity and gender. They almost always do. You don't see that many white men who study, you know, the plight of African-American women, for instance.
Okay, hands in the middle. Yeah. I saw you first, and John, you were muttering, so if you want to say something, and then we'll go to you. Go ahead.
Clearly, models have to start out simplistic.
Right.
But the whole idea of a festival looking at creativity is to find one individual who has multiple tools and who will bring about the best one for that situation.
Right.
So you can multiply simply by having someone who is not rigid but has a fluidity and a creativity.
No, that's it. In fact, there's a great book by Phil Tetlock, I don't know if you've seen it, called Expert Political Opinion. Right? It's sort of an oxymoron as a title because he shows that there are none. But he breaks people into two types, foxes and hedgehogs.
But there are none, no experts?
Yeah,
no.
He finds that people aren't very good at predicting. But what he shows is these hedgehogs, these people who just have like sort of one worldview, are terrible. And the only people who are good at all at predicting are people exactly like you say, people who are willing to sort of, you know, bring to bear lots of different ways of seeing problems and even produce new ways of seeing problems that combine old ways of seeing problems, right? So absolutely, I mean, the essence in some sense of creativity is recombination. That's true in evolutionary systems, that's true in human systems. And this gets to a key point. When we think of diversity, we often think in terms of portfolio effects, right? It's almost like insurance. But instead, we should be thinking in things in terms of the potential for super additivity, right? So if one person has one idea, right, and another person has another idea, often we can combine those ideas, right? So it's almost, it's difficult to only have two heuristics, because once I have two heuristics, I have the third heuristic, which is a combination of the two. So there's this real possibility of super additivity that comes, and this is why creativity depends on having lots of stuff in the soup.
You cited the bumper sticker, in my case, an honor student.
Right.
That's probably the generic bumper sticker is probably the most popular one out there.
Yeah.
10 years ago, Paul Rosa designed an individual, privately financed with $100,000 a year on this bumper sticker, which said, "My kid beat up your honor."
Yeah,
okay. It's not only popular, it produced some of the angriest drivers I have ever seen in trying to come to grips with what that particular version of diversity meant in an education system.
I didn't know what your presentation was going to be like.
Yeah.
I had a different concept, but I've had my own creative business for 50 years. I'm out of it now. But the thing that I found, when you talk about, and I believe I found the teams do work, but they had to be individuals who had what I would call open-minded different points of view. Because when I could get, and I didn't have to, I mean, they could cover the spectrum of, you know, based upon political beliefs or life experiences, what have you. Not just prejudices, but real, something that they really believed in. If they're open-minded, you would encourage them to say, okay, what we're here today is to say, what does the other guy know that I don't know? So that I can decide whether my point of view that I'm bringing here as a tool could be better. And it's in the creative field, that's hard because the creative people feel like their toolbox is their toolbox.
Right.
And it's one of the most difficult things is to build that kind of team. And the interesting thing, now that I've stepped down on this business, which is going on 25 years now, we've had less turnover. We have paid people dramatically more in actual compensation. And people keep asking, how do people keep working for you? Because it's a slave shop. Well, it's not a slave shop. It's a place where people feel like they're alive as human beings in the work environment, and they voluntarily want to contribute or to contribute at a higher level.
I just was going to give an interesting thing I recently heard. I cover technology. I was just talking to someone who works at Cisco, and which is, by many people's analysis, the best managed large technology company. And John Chambers has a policy he's recently been imposing in the last couple of years of creating these committees, apparently, where a variety of different levels of employee have to be on the committee, and the leader of the committee is never, almost never, the most senior person. And basically, they have to all take the committee chairperson basically is the chairperson. And they've come up with some very valuable policies for the corporation. So the insight that Chambers had as a authoritarian leader that he's got to have diversity has begun to pay off in that company.
Right. In effect, Northwest Airlines just did this as well. They wanted to figure out, you know, can we save weight on the plane? And they put together, you know, sort of from all functional areas, and it turned out like the flight attendant said, oh yeah, there's this thing on the plane that we don't use that weighs like 40 pounds, right? And there's, you know, so if you take people who have different roles in a firm, right, then they're gonna see the problem differently, and they're gonna, it gets to this sort of, you know, putting the canned salmon or the fresh salmon. But on your main point, one of the facts that really seems to play out empirically, and this is Robbins and Ely from Harvard did a survey of these, I think, 200 studies on diverse groups. If you bring a diverse group of people together, whether it's by function, whether it's by age, whether it's by identity group, whatever, and you say, we're bringing you together because it's the right thing to do, right, for, you know, sort of moral reasons, those groups do terribly. If you bring those groups together and you say, we're bringing you together because each one of you is bringing different sets of skills, you really should listen to one another. You know, if people come in, walk into the room thinking, oh, thank goodness there's people different than me, this is going to be useful, then you get these big benefits. And so one of the analogies I like to give is, imagine if you, the universities are this way, a lot of corporations are really siloed, and society's siloed. Only, I think, 10% of Americans have good friends of different races, right? They talk about meaningful things with people of different races. But if you're in a silo and somebody said to you, if you walk outside of this other silo, there's smarter people, we would walk to that other silo, right? But when you say to people in this other silo, people who are different from you, we tend to just build up our silo walls even higher, right? And what people have to learn is that people who are different than you in some sense are smarter than you, and you're also smarter than them because of the fact that you've got these different ways of seeing things, these different perspectives, different heuristics, different mental models. But breaking down those silo walls is the key. And if you can, in firms in which people are able to accomplish that are the ones that are successful.
Ashraf.
Thank you for a fascinating presentation.
Thanks.
I hear a tension between the individual as the unit of analysis and the organization as the unit of analysis.
Absolutely, yeah, and, or the team.
And you're moving
yeah.
back and forth between them
right.
without due consideration, I think.
That's right, I think that's fair.
Because yeah. Whitehead coined the term misplaced completeness.
Right.
And what is valid at the level of the individual gets to be problematic at the level of organization. One reason being organizations are dominant cultures that enforce a certain type of paradigm view. Within those, there have been some fascinating modalities of mapping mental models in clusters. And that does not usually coincide with our usual notions of diversity.
Right.
That because you're male or at a certain age or female, etc., your mental model within that is not necessarily to be read from your identity. And I feel that if more attention will pay to those mental models, for instance in Venezuela, it's been some fascinating work done of five different mental models of Venezuela.
Right.
But they don't correspond to public sector or private sector. They're individuals located in very different clusters. And at that level, the common universe, common mistakes or differences in degrees of tensions might be worth exploring.
No, absolutely. And the thing is, this is where things get really tricky. There are cases where the cultural differences really translate nicely to mental models. So two of our colleagues, Scott Atran and Douglas Medin, have stuff where they look at the cognitive mappings of the Itz and the Quechua on their ecosystems, and they have completely different
on the what?
On the ecosystems in Costa Rica in which they live, or Guatemala in which they live. And they've just got completely different maps, and you can predict ethnicity by map almost perfectly. There are other cases in which corporations have merged, and knowing someone's identity group tells you nothing about their mental models. You need to know which corporation they originally came from, right? Because that's going to determine sort of how they saw the problem.
Well, it's also the fact of so many mergers in corporate business, in business, and how often they fail is sort of an interesting challenge to your argument, because presumably a lot of different points of view are being brought, you know, into conjunction with one another, and yet somehow they're not able to extract the added value from it in many instances.
But this is the, you know, this is the getting along thing. And I think the point that he's raising here, which is a good one, is that you have this problem over time within a firm that people start seeing the problem in the same way because it eases communication and everything else, and that ends up, you know, causing problems down the road. And when you merge, you do end up with these two different, there's not only there's two things going on. One is the culture and the ways in which things are done, and then there's also this question of sort of, you know, what mental models people bring to bear. Do you have a quick follow-up?
Yeah. The merger of corporations, yeah. It's imposition of one set of models by the corporations that it's acquiring the other and not reading their assets.
I think that's
because
right.
Because they read them from their own perspective. But the key to the success of the corporation that was succeeding, that they wanted to acquire in the first place, was in a different mental model.
No, absolutely.
Not that.
Absolutely.
Questions are not required. Comments are good, too.
No, that's a great comment.
One comment. Yeah. You mentioned that the woman at the board meeting representing all women at the board meeting. I think two things can happen. Yeah. I think if you're the only O in a room full of X's, you will either be what all O's want.
Right, exactly.
Okay? Or you will do style compliance. You will, as an O, try to turn yourself into an X. So I think there's an alternative thing that happens if you're the only O in a room full of X's.
But in neither one of those cases are you sort of being true to yourself.
No,
right,
you
and that's the point.
You have to have a critical mass of O's before the O-ness can come out. I get that.
Right.
But I just want to say that there is a style compliance that may occur rather.
Absolutely.
Than
no, absolutely.
There's so much psychology that is necessarily a factor that has to be factored in.
I believe
you got more? Okay.
All right.
Okay, now you got a question too?
Getting to the more practical part of all of this, because you're bringing it fascinating because you are giving sort of the, you know, to get to diversity, you've got to get to heart and mind.
Right.
You're doing mind.
Right, absolutely.
And it's very valuable.
Right.
The hard stuff gets a little bit harder. For one thing, how do you get the historically overrepresented group to not think that it's quite risky to bring in the historically underrepresented group?
It is risky.
Well, it is. You're articulating there is some risk for that. Second, how do you do the situation where you've got, you know, if you've got one group of people in a meeting who were taught at an early age, the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Right.
And you have another group of people in the meeting, like if you're from China, where you were taught that the loudest duck gets shot.
Right.
Yeah. Or if you're from Japan, the nail that sticks out gets hit on the head.
Right.
Then you actually are talking about how you actually get the diversity because of all the different cultural norms that come along with it. Or women being indirect speakers and men just saying, can't you just get to the point?
No.
How do you make it really work so you get the benefit of the mind part of the diversity?
So first of all, you're absolutely correct in that there's this real, you know, combination of art and science in terms of how do you deal with everything from sort of, you know, cultural differences to even personality type differences, right, in terms of putting together effective teams. But one of the things, and one of the reasons for sort of, you know, turning what this book had been a set of academic papers that were extremely technical that no one ever would have read except for other, you know, economists. Right, in a tight little circle. The reason to sort of, in some sense, take my research public in a way, right, and to try and write the book in a way that other people could use it, is that I have this sense, and I think it's been true having given, you know, sort of talks over the country, that people don't really believe diversity is beneficial. And so by laying out, in some sense, the mathematics of that, you know, giving a logical argument, giving a set of formal models, giving a force equals mass times acceleration sort of logic behind it, that people can say, no, look, there really is something there, we have to figure out how to do it, is the first step. If you don't have that, if people see this as something that's being politically forced down upon them for other reasons, right, you're just not going to get the benefits. So I think and this has been shown true empirically, right, that one of the really important first steps is this question of getting people to recognize diversity as beneficial and then asking the second question, how do we leverage it? Now, your other thing about once you sort of let people who are different in, right, you get what I like to call the problem of problems. Right, one of the most important problems is what are our problems, and when you bring other people into the room, they get to, you know, decide what the problems are. So let me give an example of one of the disciplines I'm in. So in economics, there's this feeling we have no women in economics right now. I think there's still only like three, so very few. Right, so there's not many women in economics. But when the women came into economics, one of the things they did is they sort of said, well, why aren't we studying women? They're half of the people on the planet, you know. And when you look at estimates of GDP, like in the estimates of GDP in the 1850s in the United States, I like to joke, it didn't count anything Ma Ingalls did, right? Because it was just all inside the household production. The only thing that got counted in the economy was what Pa took to market once a year. Right? It was like she didn't even count. And so when you bring women in, when you brought women into the economics profession, it completely changed the set of questions because in some sense, the problem of problems, what is it that economics does, was transformed by the existence of women. So it's not, it's a, one of the things that people have to recognize, when you bring in someone who hasn't been part of the group before, not always the case you're going to sort of get different types of answers to problems. You're going to get different problems for which you're trying to find answers, which is probably a good thing.
John.
I mean, I guess a couple of comments. Yeah. One that tries to kind of unify some of what's been said here.
Yeah.
It's a little bit confusing because the model you start forward with is basically a single shot problem. It's not a compound problem. It's not a question of how do I build and build and build. It's not, and as a result, it's, some of these are very artificial examples that you give me. Basically, the real problem is if you have a group, somebody kind of brings this approach to the problem, and that suddenly triggers something else, it brings another approach to the problem, and so on and so forth. So it's a question of how to kind of get the compound to be greater than the whole more than the sum of the parts. So, for example, there's also the notion of style. So if you want to have a group, you want some convergent and some divergent. You know, if you only have convergent thinkers, then you're not going to get much of an interesting compound building, because you're not going to be able to reframe the problem at all. So in the essence, but let's go back to the inner-centered case. I don't know how much you've been following kind of Karam's work. There's now doing a much deeper analysis of, you know, why is it really possible that the people who solve the problem almost never again solve the problem. And the people that solve the problem never solve it collaboratively except maybe in groups of two. So it's very interesting. Diversity matters, but yet the person that actually solves the problem almost always does it by him or herself or by one other person. And kind of the catch was is that basically the person that solved it brought a completely pathological tool.
Absolutely.
And I say pathological because if you think of Procter & Gamble, they have thousands of subspecialties. But lo and behold, there's always one more tool that could be applied to the problem, is what that inner setup network actually unfolded. And so it was a very interesting sense that it wasn't that this person out here was smart, but he was a craftsperson around a tool. And so kind of talking about smartness, our ability, is kind of weird because it's really often what you're talking about is craftability. What is the crafts that I can assemble?
No, absolutely. Let me follow up on the first point is that predictions are one-shot things. So the analysis here is a straight one-shot thing. When you do the problem-solving stuff, that's much more of what you almost bricolage-like in the sense that, one person's going, then the next, and next, and next, and next. But what's intriguing about the incentive thing as well is that, and this plays the point, Karim is this guy at MIT who studied this stuff in depth. What he's found is two other things that when they pose the problem in such a way that it's not clear what the hell they're asking, and it's not clear whether you should be a chemist, a physicist, a biologist, a mathematician, or an artist to solve it, they're actually more likely to get a response. And it's exactly this, because they're sort of absorbing the attention of a vast set of heuristics and representations. The other thing is, and this gets to the dynamic nature of things, many times people say, I can't solve it, but I got this part. And so one of the things that at least when you hear the people involved in it give public talks, when they're trying to sell companies on sort of joining in, they'll say, maybe more important than the solutions you're getting are the wrong solutions, right? Because people are sending in, hey, this doesn't quite get it, but it came awfully close, and that becomes incredibly useful. And so I think what you want to think about is, and this is one of the problems that, having been trained again as an economist and mathematical social scientist who now works on political science, we think in terms of equilibrium models. But I tend to think of the economy as sets of problems that exist and new problems constantly churning, and us, climbing rugged landscapes in parallel all the time. And to get us off peaks,
point of view, it doesn't go up in your theorem.
It does not, well, because the thing is, when you prove a theorem, the prediction theorem is a one-shot thing, right? But in the other theorem, in the diversity trumps ability, then that is, at some point I stop the clock, right? And when I stop the clock, then I get the diverse groups living better. But there it is, it's much more dynamic.
How does bureaucracy fit into this formula? I keep thinking Bill Joy, who always talks to me about the good old days of Sun Microsystems, when it was very free-form, and they're so creative, and what happened to their company, because of things. A lot more people. So you had crowds. But it didn't help on the creativity side of things, because the company became too bureaucratic. Well, isn't that a piece of the formula?
There's a huge bullwhip problem in the sense that if things have to go through channels, right? So one reason why these prediction markets do a lot better than sort of having things filter up and go to the executive VP, and let me talk about the auto industry, which is something I know. If I'm the person who's pushed this new car through, like let's say the Ford Thunderbird that came out a few years ago that just didn't do as well as they expected, the projections internally within the firm were lousy. And the reason why is everybody said what they thought their boss wanted to hear. So everybody had a sense of this is what I think, but then they have a sense of, this is what I think my boss wants to hear. And somebody told their boss partly what they wanted to hear because their boss was determining their pay. One of the things that these prediction markets do is they preserve a level of anonymity, right? So you just, you know, you pays your money, you take your chances, but nobody knows who's saying what. But it's a way for the entire firm to sort of anonymously say to the people up and sort of sidestep the sort of bureaucratic channels.
So it's important to have anonymous channels.
It's important to have, well, for these prediction markets, it's important to have, you know, in some sense, you know, no punishment. We have some puns in my group in Ann Arbor, my working group. We have what we call killjoys and billjoys, but the which are sort of play opposite.
you could actually, top management can build a metric now on fact that basically if the prediction markets are radically different than what they've been told. That's a sign of the sickness of bureaucracy.
Right. Yeah. No, so these, it's a total canary in a coal mine sort of approach for most firms.
I want to just ask a question before we finish, which is probably one of the reasons why I was asked to moderate this thing, which is, you know, the existence of the internet is this new tool for bringing together diversity in an unprecedented way. Right. And of course, Innocentive capitalizes on that very explicitly and quite effectively. But even at a more macro level, you know, you have a billion of the population of the planet now on a common platform of communication. Is there any way to apply the thinking you have developed to what that might mean at a macroeconomic social level?
So let me end where I started. I mean, one of these stylized facts about cities being more productive, right? Because there's all this sort of diversity of skills. I think one thing that the internet's allowing is the potential for people to construct really idiosyncratic pathological toolbox sets, right? So before it was sort of like, you know, when you went to college, it was sort of like, are you going to, you know, major in engineering, French, you know, whatever, you pick some sort of major. Now I advise a lot of my sort of more technically and sharper, you know, more technically astute, sharper undergraduates to pick strange combinations of majors, to take, you know, to take an, you know, to take serious technical classes on the side to construct just this weird, you know, toolbox. Because the thing is, let me give a couple specific examples. So like...
Well, this is what liberal arts education is supposed to be about, right?
Yeah, but not so much in terms... But it was, I think, traditionally, but I think that it's been... I think that's no longer true, and I think that... But liberal arts education was more about sort of learning about history, learning about literature, learning, you know, it wasn't about sort of amassing particular sets of skills. This is more like sort of a liberal, you know, skill acquisition approach. I mean, so, you know, one example is if you think at, you know, Stephen Jobs had, you know, dropped out of school, took a bunch of calligraphy classes, right? And then he said, oh, I think I'll go back to being an engineer, right? So if you looked at all computers and you said, okay, which computer designer took calligraphy, right? You'd guess Apple. Everybody in the room would guess Apple, right? So the fact is that, you know, gaining, I think people are finding that by having strong combinations of skills and going, I think people are going to go to school longer as well. I mean, you know, people who get law degrees and engineering degrees, people who get physics degrees and art degrees are finding that the world is their oyster because of the fact they can plug in, and John can probably talk about this much more, you know, much better than I can. There's now, even though there might be only 40 places on the globe where they can plug in, they can now access those really easily. So I think it's created massive incentives for diverse, interesting people. Yeah.
I can lure you out of your field of expertise by pointing to one of the least successful and most damaging institutions in the country. It's that of marriage. And yet from the 1960s, we've matched...
That's an opinion, if I ever heard one. But anyway.
To today's e-harmony. Yeah. The emphasis has always been on finding homogeneity between members of a couple.
Right.
I wonder what your work would suggest for improving the success rate of marriage.
Well, you know, that's probably more psychology, but in terms of if you're talking economic success, you may get that, you know, more diverse couples do better. I don't know. But I mean, this is the thing that's been hard for me. I mean, I'm trained as a mathematical economist, right, and, so I'm and as a game theorist. So I'm trying to get, in some sense, I'm trying to not do psychology in a way, but try to, you know, but try and mathematize something that psychologists have done by playing, you know, by sort of laying out this formal idea of people having these perspectives and these representations and stuff like that.
Well, but that's what the field needs. Maybe too much psychology and too little of the kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I think that you can do metrics.
This is where a Center for Complex Systems really needs to include a lot of different elements within it, you know, because psychology really does enter in here in an indisputable way.
Yeah, no,
I mean, as an employee of a large multinational for 30 years myself, you know, people don't hire people in order to achieve the optimal result for their organization. In most cases, they hire people who will agree with them.
Right.
And so that is something, until the organization is in crisis, then perhaps they're forced to hire people who are more effective in some cases. But, you know, I can tell you where I work, they're not going to hire people just because they disagree with them.
Right.
That's not going
to happen. Marriage as well.
Yeah, we got to wrap it up, unfortunately.
There's a real tension here in some of the things. There's an issue of the word specialization, is, I think, an important term.
Absolutely,
And so there's an economics of knowledge specialization where there's a reason why people major or learn things, because cognitive psychology can tell you, things connect together.
Right.
So the cost of learning the first sort of building block is very high in the field.
Right.
Okay. And so, you know, at Honda, they look for, the T-shaped person, right? That's the ideal. And that, I think that is a very good heuristic for what you're looking for. But in many of these problems, diversity is forced upon you in the sense that you have a marketing part of the problem.
Right,
everybody
knows
that. You have an engineering part of the problem. You have this. And so the idea that we need more diversity, well, the diversity is, we're forced to have that kind of functional diversity. The question is, what's the correct way? Because it's not an additive or aggregation problem like this, or even a simple climbing up a random, landscape or something. There's really an issue of complementarities between actions, of the different pieces that can fit. And so those kinds of problems are, managing diversity and the economics of that, it seems to me, is really the question. How much should I learn about your specialty so that I don't screw you up? Seems to me to be more of the issue than, if we get a bunch of people who think differently, we'll make better predictions.
It's always great to have more thoughts than we can accommodate. Unfortunately, I think we have to end with that thought. Scott, fantastic. Thank you so much.